Yeah, more than words is exactly right. This is what we're learning about how we communicate. What if I told you that when you're in conversation with somebody, 90% of what they were trying to tell you was being expressed in their body, not the language choices, not their vocal inflections, not their words. If I told you that you were picking up clues from people and not even realizing it, you might believe me. But if I told you that you're also missing a ton that their body is trying to tell you might be surprised. That's the reason why we should all be reading the Body Language Handbook, how to read everybody's hidden thoughts and intentions. They're not as hidden as they think or you think. Once you know how to read what people are trying to tell you with their body more than their words. We'll talk about that with Gregory Hartley, former U.S. Army interrogator, teacher, and a guy who traveled with the special forces in Operation Desert Storm to try to find out when people were telling truth and when they were lying during their interrogations. More on that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Gregory Hartley is the co-author of the Body Language Handbook and the kind of purveyor of information like you see Tim Roth use in the TV show Lie to Me, which I find fascinating. Evening, Gregory Hartley.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing so well. And have you seen Lie to Me, the TV show that's on, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, I've seen one episode, and I know that they based the character on Paul Ekman, who is actually a psychologist and psychology professor at Stanford, and a lot of his work around universal emotions and micro expressions, that kind of work. The only problem I find with most of those muscles, and maybe other people are much more talented than I am, but my eyes are not quick enough to catch what they're talking about in terms of micro expressions.
Micro expressions. Well, that's just part of the story of body language because a lot of people speak with much. They're communicating with gestures that are much easier to follow if you know how to read them. And I think we all get the basic ones, you know, the hand over the chest, meaning closeness or anger or frustration, or the hand on the hips, you know, other things that. But there are things that are being told to us in everyday conversation that most of us are just not picking up.
Yeah, I think if you have a child in your house, children are very good at reading body language. Pets are very good at reading body language. But for some reason, as we grow older and we learn to communicate with spoken word and we pay attention to the nuance of language, we lose that very sharp edge of reading body movement, reading eye movement, reading expressions that a person might or might not be intentionally sending. A child obviously has a vested interest because they can't communicate effectively with spoken language, and because they're just open to everything, they're absorbing. As we get older, we shut off so many channels that we miss things that scream at us. Things are universal, like the flash of someone's eyebrows when they see someone they know. It's universal across all cultures, and yet we don't consciously recognize it.
Okay, talk about that then, especially as it's reflected in your experience as a former military interrogator.
And I interrogated prisoners primarily in the Middle East was my focus area, primarily because of language. I spoke Arabic, and you have to have a language to interrogate unless you're using an interpreter. What we found over the years, including whether these were English speakers, Arabs, whoever you're talking to, if someone recognizes someone very quickly, their eyebrows will rise and drop, just a quick flash, not an exaggerated holding of the brows, which indicates something else. But just that quick recognition is a flash to another person that, oh, yeah, good to see you. And you've all experienced that in your daily life. You've also experienced the opposite when you're at a party and someone you recognize someone and they don't recognize you and they have all the right words. It just feels hollow. You know something's missing. And I think you said it earlier. On a subconscious level, we recognize that. We just don't understand and can't put words to it. And you run into people every day that recognize you, that you're being kind and polite, you might say, yep, nice to talk to you again, that kind of thing. And they recognize immediately. You don't remember when you met them.
Oh, I'm pretty, by the way, I try to always be very clear of the fact when I don't remember meeting them. Because it's easy for me to admit that because it's pretty much a guarantee. And I say that sounds, it takes me I'm the dumbest guy I know. It'll take me three times really to meet somebody before I really authentically remember them. And I try never to snow people like that because I hate the way that feels when people do it to me.
Yeah, and you instinctively know it. The sad part is most of us try so hard, and you'll never get past that. If you're even to the point, though, if I'm sitting across the room from someone, and I tell people this all the time when I'm teaching, as I raise my brow quickly in that fashion, you can watch someone go through their mental Rolodex trying to figure out how they know you.
Right. So let me take you back again to being a military interrogator, because then you're not only – then you're reading the body language of somebody who's under stress.
Right.
And is that different than just bumping into somebody at a dry cleaner?
It is, absolutely. But what we know about people is there's a baseline, a floor that you can start from. If you think about a polygraph, and a polygraph measures three channels, then what a polygraph does is takes a floor level reading or a baseline and works from that. So you can start from an elevated, if you will, baseline, but you can still see deviations. The same thing is true in interrogation. You just have to be more attuned to the subtleties. You have to pay much closer attention than you would in a casual conversation with someone on a daily basis.
Okay, but I mean, so you've picked somebody up. But take me through a typical experience as you can recall, or that you want to use sort of emblematically of what you did, without obviously revealing state secrets, of interrogating somebody under duress who is a suspected terrorist or somebody who has information about terrorism, and you've got to get it out of them, or you've got to be able to get the information out of them that they don't want to give you by reading their body language. Take me through an experience that's typical of that for you.
Yeah, and probably this is probably the most interesting part of interrogation is everything you see, all of the parts that you see are the tip of the iceberg. So if you will, most of the time a good interrogator spends getting information is done outside of the interrogation room. We take everything. First of all, I'll take you through a normal process. Someone is captured in a given location, or they're abducted in a raid. What we know about that person comes typically from the capture documents, and they're tagged by the people who capture them. They're tagged with all of the information about the location, about who they were captured with, how much equipment they were captured with. Ideally, and this rarely happens because of the nature of process and people, is we would get a bag with everything the person was captured with at the time, and they've had their clothing removed, they've had their clothing replaced so that we know they have nothing dangerous on them, and we have control over their entire environment at that point. We spend a couple of hours preparing for that interrogation. We find out everything we can possibly about them. We passively observe them, pay attention to who we're talking to, look at everything we can see from a distance, how they interact with other people, whether those are prisoners or guards. Then we talk to the guards, people who are closest to them. We find out information about them. Then we go in and we start the interrogation. And we start the conversation by taking control of the conversation. I kid around with people, but honestly mean this. An interrogation is not very different from any other meeting. Too much has been made of it in TV and then this travesty that was Abu Ghraib, that interrogation is shouting and pushing and snatching. Good interrogation is high psychological pressure, and it's pressure and release. You put enough pressure on the person to get them to feel as though they have one direction to go, and that's the direction you want them to go. Some of the best interrogations are conversations that seem friendly. And what you're looking for is you start off the conversation with something we would call a control question. You ask a question you know the answer to. And when you're asking that question that you know the answer to, the person's going to respond truthfully. And you can look for what's normal when they're answering truthfully. And these can be simple questions, things about daily life. They can be things that you already know about them, things they've already said. And what you're doing is delving into their information. You can look for things like eye movement to indicate which part of their brain they store information. You can look for cadence, speech patterns, choice of words, and all of the body language associated, how they illustrate their information with their hands, how they illustrate their information with their eyes. Look for changes in their pupil dilation to indicate stress. All those things play in.
All right. Now, I want more of that, but I also want to back up a little bit. Do you have to know whether they're left or right-handed in order to understand which direction their eyes go? Do you have to know where they are on this? And this is, I can't remember if this is in your book or not, so pardon me. That they're where they are on the autism spectrum before you can start to get information from them. I mean, aren't there some things that you need to know just to have a so that you're not out of the box misinterpreting a look left or down before you're making wrong assessments?
Yeah, I think you do. And what we do is typically we start our conversation in that way. I would ask a question, left or right-handed, although the eye movement correlates to left and right-handed in terms of percentage, it doesn't correlate in terms of actuality, because as many people as I've talked to in my life, I've not found a correlation between whether you look left for memory and being left-handed, for example. I've not found any correlation whatsoever. Hmm. So that one you can get around. What I typically do is people have a natural tendency to mirror people that they know or they're trying to get to know and like. So or to someone they perceive as alpha. So when you're in an interrogation, typically you're perceived as alpha. If you relax the situation and you place your hands together, I mean, you can even start to pay attention to the person, how they respond to your body language, and you can pick up on whether they're left or right-handed. Autism.
Yeah, autism. That's because they just use body language, or they see body language differently, don't they? Generally, people who have at least even Asperger's or other people have a hard time looking you in the eye or something like that.
Yeah, and Asperger's is an interesting one because they simply can't, and like all things with humans, it's on a bell curve, you know, from marginal through extreme. So if a person is an extreme case of Asperger's, they cannot recognize any human emotion, and it makes it very difficult for them. On the far end, they might just miss cues. The interesting piece for me is I've worked with Adam Larson, who has a current independent film on autism called Neurotypical, and I watched through some of the case studies of people living daily lives who have Asperger's and autism. The only thing that I could quickly pick out from the group is a lack of brow involvement in conversation. So their conversation, when they were talking to you, showed no brow movement whatsoever.
What do you learn from eyebrows, Greg Hartley?
Well, the one universal, the eyebrow flash is a good one. People use their brows, and everyone who had a mother, which is most of us, you can see a brow rise for skepticism, raising one brow, looking at you as they say, really, and ask and quiz you. You can also see what I refer to as a request for approval. When a person's talking to you and they're trying to get something past you, they'll hold their brows up as they're talking. And especially as they lilt their conversation towards the end, if you notice that person and you pay attention to them and you give them immediate approval, you'll notice the brow drop and go back to a normal, moving, constantly kind of movement. When you're looking at a person who is doing that to you and they're holding their brow up, I don't mean like a flash, but suspended in space kind of time, then I'm always suspect to that person. When they're telling me the truth with their brow up, I'm constantly wondering why they need approval. And I'll dig a little deeper and find out whether it's just because they're feeling stress or whether they're intimidated, whatever the case, because interrogation is an intimidating thing.
Right. And so it's possible that they're telling you the truth, which they're just desperate to have you believe because nobody's ever believed them up until this moment. So the eyebrows are up with a kind of please don't judge me like everybody else kind of look.
Sure, and you run into that. You know, I think about people, I watch, like everyone else, I watch every show on TV to look and see where someone has seen something out of the normal.
Right.
I would love to be the person asking the questions. Because since you have little control, you have no control to find out other pieces of information to support. So a lot of times those people can be written off as not knowing anything or having made all the details up, if you're simply looking at it that way. But if you ask follow-up questions and delve in deeper, you can find out what's the driver. And if you don't do that in interrogation, you're going to miss facts.
Okay, very interesting. So you've gone into you were going into the timeline of an interrogation. You ask a potential terrorist or somebody who has information about terrorism some baseline questions about family. You're fluent in Arabic. Are people around the world consistent in how they use body language as it corresponds to spoken words, or do some cultures have a distinct body language just like they have a spoken language?
Well, interestingly, if you think about the whole human family, there are only so many movements we can all make. We're not going to come up with some new movement tomorrow. But right. If anything, what culture does is curtail use of that. So, for instance, holding up our middle finger to illustrate something, to point to something on the board, is just not done in the U.S. because it indicates something else. So every time something takes on a universal meaning, we'll call that a gesture. So things like holding up your thumb as a gesture, or middle finger, or two fingers, any of those things are gestures because we universally understand what they mean. If there's one thing that occurs universally in culture, it's a pairing of language down to, you can't do that to mean this. And a good example is, I had a friend when I was young, a young interrogator, who would try to make his point by putting all of his fingers on his left hand and his thumb together, holding it up, and tapping it with his index finger on his right hand. The minute he walked into Baghdad, that became an issue because that indicates someone's of questionable parentage. That's a good example of how something can't be used. Now, cultures also develop normal ways of illustrating. So if we run through the four big body language pieces, gesture is one, and gesture is universally understood movement to create a sentence or phrase or word that everyone understands, like okay or let's go, those kinds of things. But then you have four other categories. One is an illustrator, and that's what I'm doing sitting here, although you can't see it, moving my hands as I speak. That's my brain punctuating what I'm thinking. Now, we'll talk about that in terms of how that can give away a liar, but illustrators are my brain punctuating what I'm thinking with some body part. Adapters are my trying to find comfort as I feel stress, and that might be tugging at an ear, rubbing your head, rubbing your thigh, playing with your fingernails, twirling your hair, and it takes on any one of a number of movements. It can become so idiosyncratic that we don't notice it ourselves, but those close to us, like your wife, your friends, right, they notice when you're stressed.
I'd probably do all those. So you're interrogating somebody, and you notice, I mean, you get them to follow you. You can tell that they're buying into your status now as the alpha in the group, and then you try to get them to tell you the truth about something. What are the first couple of questions how will you phrase a question in order to maximize the potential that you'll get truth?
You know, typically you're very careful with your wording. If you ask a question that's open-ended, you'll get them to start telling you a story. You never want to say, take a leading question. We've all heard that in court, leading the witness. If I ask you a yes and no question, I'm directing the conversation. I'm taking you in a new direction. Now, junior interrogators are taught never to do that, never to lead the conversation. A sophisticated interrogation includes leading questions to redirect someone back to a point you want to talk. So, for instance, I'd start off the conversation just by saying, what were you doing at the time you were captured? First of all, you're going to verify veracity because the person's going to tell you whatever they want you to hear, or they're going to tell you the truth. And you have that documented. There were people there who wrote down what they were doing. In addition to, and believe it or not, that's the first place most people will start to lie. And they'll also bleed information in terms of choice of words. One of my favorites was doing a TV show for UK4 where we brought 9 British volunteers in, and 3 had committed crimes in the scenario. Now, they made these guys go out and do a real world recreation of whatever they were supposed to be doing so that we would have visual memories of that. And I'll talk in a minute about eye movement. But as we asked the one guy a question, I said, what are you doing here? And the guy said, I'm not doing anything wrong. Good indicator right off. Why would he say that?
Right.
Why wouldn't he tell you what he's doing? And then I said, no. Okay, so what were you doing here? He said, I'm just here earning an honest living. Now he's giving me a negotiation word. Normal people don't say, I'm here earning an honest living. You might hear that on occasion. It becomes a speech pattern. So you push on it. And all I said was, did I say you were doing anything wrong? And when I said that, the guy said, I just work with underprivileged kids. I recruit them from the streets. Telling and interesting.
Right. Oh, that's just where we'll start picking it up. The Body Language Handbook. Gregory Hartley helps interpret that also to our lives. But we'll find out more about terrorist interrogations, trying to get information from people with whom he is in a hostile relationship. And I want to ask him about, like the famous moments, Bill Clinton, John Edwards, anybody, for that matter, George W. Bush, anybody who's been caught in a lie. Was he able to see that before we were next on Coast to Coast? If you missed Andrew Zimmern on earlier, go catch that on the podcast through Streamlink. You can link up to that at coasttocoastam.com. You know, Andrew Zimmern, who eats a lot of bizarre foods, he throws the occasional eyebrow at the camera. I know he's very good about not judging too much with his voice. And he is as open as anybody could possibly be under those circumstances. But on occasion, he'll throw an eyebrow at you. And you know darn well he's not enjoying the experience as much as he is hospitably trying to indicate to the host of the occasion. Anyway, you find out more by going back and catching the first part of that. Go online to coasttocoastam.com, link up to Andrew Zirin and his book, and also to the blog about the Wolfman, the movie that opened up this weekend. I had a couple of thoughts on the true story of that when it comes to Nazi Germany and more coming up next with our guest Gregory Hartley for the rest of the show. The Body Language Handbook, how to read everyone's hidden thoughts and intentions. We're talking about Gregory Hartley's years as a military interrogator and how he was able to tell when terrorists were telling the truth or not. And that was a very interesting line of questioning we're just getting to coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. The Body Language Handbook help you do anything you do better by better understanding what people are communicating to you intentionally or unintentionally. And I think that's part of learning to read people's bodies is also learning when they how they act when they think they're getting away with something and their body gives them away instead. So we were talking about an interrogation as Gregory Hartley would have done typically when he was with the military. As you were saying, you know, people might respond in, using, you know, just regular spoken language, might say to you something like in response to your question of what were you doing? Right away, they start talking in terms of guilt or innocence or, you know, as you said, these sort of negotiating words like I was making an honest living and other things they're putting on the table. But what is their body doing while they're saying these things that may or may not betray the words?
Well, in the case of this particular guy during the UK 4 filming, his brow was up high and requesting approval. You know, he's saying, I was earning an honest living. I work with kids. I work with underprivileged kids, and I recruit them from the streets. At the same time, his palms were up in an expression of helplessness. But here's an interesting piece. When a person is being open and honest, typically their arms are away from their body. Their elbows are away from their torso. When they're not being honest, even though their hands are up, their palms are up, their elbows are tight against their torso. So all those pieces were indicative that something was going on. The tone of his voice was higher than it should have been. And given that this, even though it was a TV show, was very stressful because we just strip searched him and gone through the whole process, it was a good indicator that what he was saying with his mouth and what his body was punctuating with illustrators were two different messages.
As you watch other things on television, like, say, Bill Clinton's famous I did not have sex with that woman speech, or John Edwards recently looking into the camera, dead on looking at the camera, saying these are lies about me having a baby and having somebody other than Elizabeth. These are lies. I'm not even going to talk about them because they're lies, or anything that any other president has ever said. How much can you pick up? What is your lens like on somebody who might even be too broad a brush, a politician, you know, a professional liar?
Well, yeah, I agree with you there. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, that sounds mean, but these people are used to obscuring the truth. So how good are they versus you? Are you able to see right through them?
Well, interestingly, Bill Clinton is a great example of what happens with time. Bill Clinton, when he first went in the White House, was one of the worst liars on the planet. I mean, anytime he would lie, you could read him very simply.
Like how? What do you mean?
Well, let's take Monica Lewinsky. He was doing classic signs of lying. So, for instance, when you're thinking about how a person illustrates their information, when a person is normally speaking versus when a person is trying to beat you over the head with the truth, when they're beating you over the head with the truth, they take a whip or a stick and they beat you with it, quite literally, as they're trying to drive home the point, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. You could not be more cliche than, now listen to me, I'm only going to say this one more time. I did not have sex with that woman, holding his finger and beating you with a figurative stick. That is the most cliche that someone is not telling the truth. When they start whipping you with the truth, you should be concerned about that. And the other thing is he did several other things in his speech pattern. I did not have sex with that woman. So my favorite parts of that are that's distancing from the lie. Put as many words in between as you possibly can. But more importantly, he talks specifically about a single woman, not anyone else. So next time you come up and say, well, what about intern number two?
Right.
I didn't say anything about her.
Right. So, yeah. And I would offer that probably he thought by saying that woman, he was trying to be so specific that he was trying to that he was using that woman as emphatic language. Like, that is just not true.
But it's the brain punctuating what he's thinking. And yeah. Choice of words are usually great for push and pull. In that case, we would have, if I were talking to someone in an interrogation, I would negotiate that word and figure out why he chose to use it.
Right.
But interestingly, the problem is all of us are going to do exactly those things. We distance from the question or we condition the question. That woman, it's a conditioning of the question. So it's nothing that he's done that other presidents haven't. But what happened with Bill Clinton, his eye movement and everything else was more erratic when he first started. By the time he left office, he was very smooth. His eye movement was hard to read. His mannerisms, his cadence of speech, his shifting from one mannerism to the other became less jerky when he was under stress. And it's arguably, you could say there's no more stressful job on the planet than being president
right.
of the United States.
Right.
So his baseline is never going to be normal for a human when he's under stress.
All right. Now, and I know as a military guy, I hope you feel free to talk about this, but if for whatever reason you can, I understand. How about the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, which now a couple of books have come out that have said essentially the White House knew much earlier than they were willing to admit that they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, or that if there were weapons of mass destruction, it was like a 1% chance at this point that they were going to suddenly pop up in a pile somewhere. Did you see anything during that whole process, or when Colin Powell was in front of the UN talking about weapons of mass destruction, that lets you think, uh-oh, this isn't what they say it is?
Well, I would venture to say they probably had some root of truth to whatever they were saying, and they were quite comfortable with talking about it. But my thing I've often said is the day George Bush was elected, I said, well, here come two things that you can guarantee. One is going to be a tax cut, and the other is going to be the invasion of Iraq at all costs. And the reason I said that was we walk around typically with our father's image in our head. And, you know, I am not, regardless of my political views, I'm never jaundiced to the person. I'm never going to look at a person and say this person is better than that because of party. And I'm always suspicious of motivation when I hear those kinds of things. When I saw George Bush has a strange kind of a request for approval. If you remember his face, he would get this kind of what I call the goofy country boy look.
Right.
That was his request for approval. When he was trying to push something past you, you'd have that goofy kind of big...
folksy.
Yeah, it was that scrunched eyebrow and the big smile.
Right.
A smile, a real smile, does not involve the eyebrows. The muscles are at odds with each other.
Hmm. That's very interesting. So you were picking up when he would go into approval mode that he was looking for you to say it was okay for him to keep doing what he was doing, even though he may have been doubtful about what he was doing.
Exactly. If you think about the muscles of the face, and if you look at musculature of the face, the jawline is a massive muscle group. The cheekbones have massive muscle groups, and the forehead has a massive muscle group. It's not hard to imagine that those three things work in certain combinations. And then if you see a real smile, the cheeks are involved, the eyes are involved, and you can see wrinkles around the eyes, and the forehead is flat, typically in a real smile. But when a person's smiling nervously, their forehead can be involved, and it creates an odd look for us. We instinctively should recognize that grief muscle, that piece right in the center of the forehead, engaged at the same time a smile is engaged, is a mixed message.
As a body language expert, Gregory Hartley, who lies more, Democrats or Republicans?
Good question. Whoever's on the hot seat at the moment, that's about what it
is. Okay, so pretty equally, kind of even between the two of them.
Yeah, we're in the business of making 51% of the people happy, you're going
right?
to lie.
You know, and I'm gonna throw something at you, and I really don't have a background for this. So again, just feel free to just sort of quickly back away from the question and change the subject if you want. But I've sort of always been interested in people who struggle with either living in a fact-based world or people who tend to confuse having an opinion with having their own facts. And so that they tend to think that if it's an opinion, that it's also based in fact, when in fact, most opinions are just sort of based on how we feel emotionally about something, not necessarily intellectually. That's my theory. So I watch somebody like, and I could easily talk about John Edwards, but in this case, I'm really going to talk about Sarah Palin, but I think they're cut out of the same cloth. For me, John Edwards and Sarah Palin are very close, and as I experience them, because I feel from them, people who struggle with telling the truth, when a lie, they tell a lie when telling the truth would have been just as easy. How does that sound? I think it's typical of adult children of alcoholics that somehow they go for a lie or an exaggeration when it would have been just as easy to tell the truth.
Well, I think what they're after is approval. I think you hit it dead on the adult children of alcoholics. You know, they're constantly trying to be accepted and trying to get approval. In the case of John Edwards, you know, he had built an image around, there's a whole thing around personal extinction. If there's one thing that allows us to get people to divulge state secrets, it's that whole perception of loss of identity, that whole perception of personal extinction.
Extinction, that's a very interesting term.
And for me, what personal extinction means is I can't even tell you what's in the little box, but every person listening to you has a little box that they can't even probably define. But in that box are three or four things. And if I can take three of them and leave the fourth and then flirt with that fourth one, that's personal extinction, and it's how we can get the world's worst terrorists to talk. It's actually the right way to get people to talk, not waterboarding or those kinds of things. So when you get to the point the person realizes you have control over their psyche, you have control over their psychological well-being, and you know who they are, it's the effect of the person. You know, it's like a squirrel on the road. Where do you go? They have no idea. These guys are in the public eye and have crafted this identity that they even start to fall for themselves. And then they get to a point where they're questioned about something that could be, and they have some pretty good questioners going after them at any given time, that could become personal extinction. In the case of John Edwards, your point about eye contact, Americans believe that people who shift their eyes away from the camera or shift their eyes away from eye contact are lying. That is the biggest fallacy in all American body language. When a person is staring me in the eyes and talking to me, I call that the hypnotic gaze.
Yeah.
I am extremely suspicious of that person because your eyes move in your head when you're talking.
Yeah, and that's the thing about John Edwards, and it's also, to me, something I saw in that last Sarah Palin interview where it just seemed like she was totally contradicting herself on using the word retard, and it's a word I hate. I don't use it. I don't believe in it. And I couldn't believe that she was, you know, parsing it to be making some point about it's okay to use it as satire, but, you know, but if you, as long as you're making a political point, you're calling a kook a retard, then that's okay. And that didn't make any sense. And I was looking at her body. I was trying to read her face and her body. And here's what I saw in that is a kind of, I could be totally wrong, but it seemed like a kind of desperation. Like I'm going to say this and I'll say it big and I'll say it strong. And I'll say it in every way that looks emphatic, but I thought, God, it seemed like it was betraying. Gosh, I weren't doing that. I wish I weren't doing this. I wish I weren't having to say this.
Yeah, and I think too many of our politicians are too much like our celebrities. Celebrities get away with it for one reason. They're not politicians. And when you get a person, you know, I've often said that some of the worst of people end up in Hollywood. And we expect them to suddenly become good people. Well, they're not. They're scumbags, and they just happen to have a lot of cash. That's all it is.
And some talent. I mean, they've got some talent, but...
Right. Well, they got there through talent, right? I'm not taking anything away from there are some very good people in Hollywood as well. But there are some scumbags, and they just happen to have talent enough to make a lot of cash. Well, that's a different skill set than we expect from people making national-level decisions for us.
Right. So,
and we don't want actors in that role, but for some reason, Americans seem to be falling more and more in love with an image and less in love with substance.
I think that's such a good point, and that brings me back to John Edwards. I've never trusted him. I never liked him. I just thought he was lying. There was something about him that just made me totally uneasy, and I'm going back a decade on how I feel about John Edwards, and something had to do with the hair. It had to do with a lot of stuff. And
too much polish.
It just seemed like he was just he seemed like he was putting such a huge effort in trying to be too good to be true.
You know, I often tell people when someone is going that far, every person that is listening, you, I, we all have things in our psyche we don't want people
sure.
to know about.
Right.
But when a person is broadcasting how great and how wonderful and how this and that they are, it's often, I mean, what's his name? Ted Haggard, I think was his
name. Right, sure.
Look at that. Crusading against homosexuality while you're having sex with a male prostitute.
Right.
Those kinds of things, that over-the-top behavior often is a good indicator there's something else that they're compensating for. It's the push-pull word again.
Yeah, and I love that concept of personal extinction. It kind of reminds me of, do you know the fairy tale Rumpelstiltskin,
mm-hmm.
right? And remember that the woman had to keep turning straw into gold, wasn't it? And
right.
and the only way she could get out of it was if she guessed the name of this magic guy's his real name. And I thought I was taught this once in a college lit class. I don't know if it's true, but I thought it was interesting that really by guessing the name Rumpelstiltskin, she guessed his greatest secret, his most damaging secret, in that he was impotent, and that Rumpelstiltskin literally means he had a Stiltskin that was rumpled and wouldn't work.
Right.
And that by guessing that it went right to the core of his power, and he was immediately powerless.
And I think that's the key, that when you hear these people doing a lot of tap dancing, that's exactly it. They're afraid of being discovered. I think that's the whole reason for requesting approval. Think about the adult children of alcoholic. The whole thing, the whole process is there. It's the same idea. Don't guess the horrible thing I'm hiding. The interesting piece is most of us have it, but most of us get to a realization that, okay, there's something about my psyche I wouldn't want everyone to know, but okay, that's life. We all have it.
Yeah, and I don't mean when I brought up ACOA people. It's something I've been around my whole life, and my father was damaged with this, and the adult children of alcoholics, if you don't go through if you don't go even through a minimum amount of self-reflection and therapy, and you start dealing with a life that was sort of built around guarding a family secret, mom or dad is an alcoholic, don't let anybody know, let's let everybody think on the outside that the world is perfect inside these doors, when we all know it's completely upside down. I mean, that starts a pattern which goes into adulthood often, and it puts people, it turns people into dynamic liars, and they get really good at that. And it's with a very sort of molten core that can get volcanic. We're talking about the Body Language Handbook, how to read everyone's hidden thoughts and intentions. What's the number one tell that somebody has? It doesn't have to be about lying. It doesn't have to be, it could be a positive one. It could be, I'm attracted to you or whatever. But what's the number one thing that almost everybody on the planet does?
Well, the most interesting is pupil dilation. In terms of attraction, this is the chemical thing we have no control over. When we're looking at someone we're sexually attracted to, our pupils dilate because we want to see more of a good thing. It's a fantastic human reaction. And
very
few people know that. You know, I taught Homeland Security. I've taught Army interrogators. Of course, when you're talking to 25-year-old males, that's the first thing they want to know. So that's the one they always ask. How can I tell she's attracted?
Right. Now, how about the hand to the hair? I thought that was one of those, if a woman is playing with her hair, that's a sign of self-conscious attractiveness.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer that body language means something, but I'm also a big baseliner, and I know that human behavior is rooted in the person's psyche. So I'm not a believer that is always universal, but I am a believer that there are things you can't overcome, and the pupil dilation is one.
Good, because I often put my hands to my head and my hair, even when I'm talking to like nuns or something, and I hope they're not thinking I'm attracted. I was trying to be really self-conscious and put my hands in my pockets and stuff. The Body Language Handbook, how to read everyone's hidden thoughts and intentions. We're just getting started. Sometime in the next hour, we'll open up the phones for you to join the conversation too with Gregory Hartley, former U.S. military interrogator. Tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, I'll be doing the show, and we'll revisit the smiley face killers. This is some people say it's an urban legend. There's been a dearth of actual official investigations into this alleged serial killer ring. However, we'll talk to the reporter who's on the case full time now. We'll talk to a former medical examiner who says in at least one of these cases they can prove that there was a murder involved that the police are refusing to investigate. And then hopefully a former federal agent as well on that tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.